millennia, religions have concocted numerous manifestations of heaven and the afterlife, and though no one has ever returned from such a place to report what it is really like, or that it even exists, today's science and technology are being used to try to make it happen in our lifetime. In the book we're looking at today, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia, Dr. Michael Shermer sets out to discover what drives humans' belief in life after death, focusing on recent scientific attempts to achieve immortality, along with utopian attempts to create heaven on Earth. From radical life extension, to cryonic suspension, to mind uploading, Shermer considers how realistic these attempts are from a proper skeptical perspective, and concludes with an uplifting tribute to purpose and progress, and a word on how we can live well in the here and now, whether or not there is a hereafter. Dr. Michael Shermer is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, and a presidential fellow at Chapman University, where he teaches Skepticism 101. He joins me today to tell us about his latest book. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Secularism. My name's Carrie Lynn Evans, and I'm joined today by Dr. Michael Shermer to talk about his book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Just to start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to work in this field?
Oh, well, my background is in experimental psychology and the history of science. I have two graduate degrees, and I was just doing the regular college professor thing and started the Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society in my garage, and just really as a hobby. And it took off in the 90s, and it kind of became all-consuming, and it to the point where I quit being a professor and just became a full-time public intellectual, as it were, magazine publisher and editor. And then I got a monthly columnist position at Scientific American and started writing my books and giving public talks and so on. And I'm still a college professor, but just part-time, an adjunct professor at Chapman University now. But my main job is really just writing my books and my columns and publishing Skeptic Magazine. And, you know, our thing is science. You know, science and reason is the best tools we have for understanding the world and how it works, and for making social change and moral progress.
Exactly. Perfect. All right. Can you give us a sense of the background to this book, how it came about?
Well, Heavens on Earth is something of an extension of my previous books, which is usually how I do it. I try not to write the same book every time, like some authors seem to do. I try to push myself in new areas that I don't know that much about, so that I can learn something and grow and develop my thinking and ideas. And, you know, so I've written about science and pseudoscience, science and religion, science and God, science and morality. So science and the afterlife is kind of the next big one, you know, kind of the ultimate questions that people care about and that matter in our lives. And so what do scientists and philosophers have to say about that? And it turns out to be a pretty huge subject. I mean, there's, of course, the standard religious versions of the afterlife that everyone knows about, Judeo-Christian, Muslim, monotheism views of heaven. But the focus of my book is, although I deal with those, is more on the scientific attempts. As you noted in the subtitle, it's a book on science. So what's the scientific attempts? Well, this is all the, you know, cryonics people that want to freeze and reanimate you in centuries hence, or the mind uploaders, or the transhumanists, the extropians, the singularity people, the radical life extensionists, and, you know, all these interesting, super interesting groups and organizations and even companies that are funding this research in a big way to try to do what? Well, that's the question. You know, in general, you know, I think that the idea is like what Woody Allen said, I don't want to live on in my work. I want to live on in my apartment. You know, how can we just keep going? And, you know, your show's about secularism. Most of these people are atheists. You know, they don't think there's an afterlife unless we make it happen, or, you know, keep going somehow. So it scales up from just kind of the normal stuff that we should be doing anyway, you know, diet and exercise and eating and living relatively healthy lives, just to try to make it to the upper ceiling, which is about 120. So I debunk the myth that people are living twice as long today as they used to live. People lived into their 80s and 90s and even into their hundreds centuries ago. It's just not very many of them did. Now, today, thanks to modern medicine and vaccinations, public health, and so on, more and more of us are reaching the upper ceiling, but no one's going to break through that 120 year or so upper ceiling without something dramatic happening. So that's where the action is. You know, what are some of these new technologies and techniques people are developing? And so I explore a lot of that in the book.
Yeah. And you begin by looking at the long history of thought and various coping strategies that have resulted from our awareness of our mortality, including those referred to as immortality narratives. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the problem is that you can't actually imagine yourself being dead. I mean, go ahead and try it. people imagine their bodies in a casket or something, and friends and family are there, and hopefully they're mourning. But, you know, of course, you can't imagine anything when you're dead, because to imagine something, you have to be alive. So, you know, there's something of a paradox. We see death around us. It's real. All 100 billion people that lived before us have died, and none have come back. So clearly, it's a real thing, of part of our existence, but yet I can't imagine even what that's like. So on the one hand, on the positive side, there's really nothing to worry about, because there's nothing to experience. It's just lights out, that's it. But on the other hand, because I can't imagine it, and I can only imagine continuing, and so this is where the action starts, where the kind of dualistic idea that something continues on beyond my physical body. And this starts very early. There's research like in Paul Bloom's lab at Yale, where they give kids these a little puppet show, where this little mouse gets munched by this alligator and that mouse is dead. And yes, these little kids, these are preschoolers. You know, where's the mouse now? Oh, mouse is in this other place, and he misses his mommy, and he's hungry, and he's scared, and, you know, as if something continues on. This is very early. So,
right.
You know, we are natural born dualists. We just naturally think that there's something continues. And, you know, it's completely understandable why you can't sense your brain operating. It feels no pain, for example. And so when you, you know, hear voices, or, you know, imagine imaginary beings or whatever, angels and demons and aliens and whatnot, to the person that experiences it, they're really out there somewhere, because you can't sense it happening in your brain. So that sets up this idea of a soul, a mind. You start with something, you know, super simple, like it feels like I have thoughts in my head. You know, I don't feel neurons swapping neurochemical transmitter substances across synaptic gaps. All I feel like is like there's thoughts floating around up there. And the soul is something like that, that, you know, this kind of dualistic nature we have of imagining something continuing, you know, a body and a soul, a brain and a mind, a corporeal and incorporeal, matter and material and immaterial. So we have these words that represent constructs that we have. And from there, it's pretty easy to start imagining then, well, what's it like on the other side? And then, of course, that's where it gets interesting, where all these different religions and you know, people have these different ideas of where you're going and what it's like there.
Yeah. And you actually challenge the notion that facing death is terror-inducing. You were looking at death row inmates.
That was one of the pretty interesting data sets I came across. I started reading about this terror management theory, which is a legit cognitive theory about, it's pretty extreme, actually, that all of civilization, everything we do, creativity, architecture, writing, music, literature, everything is driven by this subconscious fear of death, and that we become creative this way. Okay, so I pretty thoroughly debunk that. I don't think that's the driving force. In fact, if you look at, well, what is it people think about when they think about death? Because that's what this research is based on. You know, how would you know? Because, you know, do we have a data set on this? Well, we do. Yeah. Death row inmates are given a chance to give a final statement. So here's a group of people that, you know, they know they're going to die. They know the exact time of their death. You know, it's, you know, at 12:15 a.m. on this date, boom, and it happens. And so there they are on the gurney with the needles in their arms, and the microphone comes down. Would you like to say anything? And most of them do. So the Texas Department of Justice actually records them and puts them on their webpage so you can read them. So I did a whole content analysis with some grad students that we all coded them and then ran an inter-rater reliability correlation between them, just make sure we were reading this and categorizing the same things. And by far and away, the most common thing was just a sense of love for their fellow inmates, their parents, their moms. These are mostly almost all men. There were only three women executed in the state of Texas in the last 40 years. So it's pretty pretty wild. So it's all these guys, you know, love it. They love their mom, their sister, their wives, their buddies on death row and so on. They ask for forgiveness and there's no sense of terror or anxiety at all. And so that's kind of an interesting idea. You know, what is it you're going to think about when that time comes? And so we actually have an idea of that.
You also look at the conception of heaven and the afterlife historically, starting with the traditions of the monotheist religions, which makes sense, and on to how various conceptions of heaven have evolved over time within those traditions and without.
Yeah, so you have to deal with the big three, because that's, you know, that's what, about 3 billion, a little over 3 billion people, or almost half the world's population, are monotheists. So, but even there, Jews, Christians, and Muslims don't agree on what the afterlife is like, or even how to get there. I mean, Jews are the least of the three religions to believe in an afterlife at all. I mean, originally, the idea of what happens after you die in Judaism, this is before Christianity, was nothing happens. You just go to you go no place. You go to this place that's nowhere. It's we don't even really have the words for it. It's just, you cease to exist. It's not like you're going nowhere. There's nowhere to go.
Right.
You know, it's a really strange idea once you start thinking about it. You know, it's like, that's why elsewhere in the book, I asked, you know, imagine no universe. Well, what do you mean? Well, like no people, no planets, no stars, no galaxies. Yeah. Okay. No light. So it's only dark. Yeah. Well, but there's not even space or time. There's just nothing. And you can't even imagine that because, you know, again, to imagine something, you have to have a brain and so on. So, you know, it's something like that. You know, imagine what happens when you die. You just, it's where you were before you were born. Nowhere. You know, and you didn't exist. There was no existence. So, you know, and originally Judaism was something like that. But then after Descartes and the whole Cartesian dualism idea kind of took on in the Western world, Christianity really glommed on that idea, and it trickled down into some Judaism sects where there's actually a place you go. And then, of course, it got grafted on the good and bad, you know, heaven and hell and all that entails. And Islam mostly uses that and then heaven becomes something, well, the afterlife becomes something of a cosmic courthouse where all moral scores are settled, and Hitler didn't get away with it. You know, he's going to meet his maker along with the serial killers and school shooters and everybody else. So, you know, then it becomes modernized in that sense. And you know, and then of course they also, well, how do you get there? You know, so then there's a whole set of, you know, criteria about what lets you in or not, works or words, or, you know, by who you are, the chosen, the elect. You know, there's a judgment, you know, and so on. And what's interesting about that is they all have a different history and they all get to different ends. And, you know, I'm a historian of science by training. You can read the history of cosmology, say, and there's a sense that we're getting closer and closer to a deeper, true understanding of what's really out there and when it started and where it's going and so on. There's nothing like that with heaven. It's not like, oh boy, they made this major discovery in 1672 using this telescope, and now we know a little bit more about heaven. No. This is all just armchair philosophizing, just sitting there thinking about what it might be like and then making up stories. And so it's really more like fiction, more like science fiction fantasy. Let's just imagine this other world. And then, you know, and then people hear it and they're taught it from a young age and they just assume it's true. And they're told, like little kids are told, you know, well, what happened when, you know, sorry about my dog. His name is Hitch, by the way.
Oh, really? Oh, how nice.
Yeah. Yeah. But he doesn't like whiskey. So anyway, so, but, you know, like dogs, children are taught, you know, well, what happened to grandma when she died? Well, she, you know, she's in heaven. She went to this other place. And if you think about that, that's sort of a bizarre thing to say to somebody. It's as if she's still alive somewhere, but we don't get to see her anymore. And I mean, none of this really makes sense as a thing to tell kids, but it's what we do. I think we do it because it makes us feel better. And that's much of what this is about. It's not for the dead. It's for the living, you know, to just kind of try to answer that question. But as I said at the start, there's really nothing to fear because you can't experience death. The most you could experience would be just the dying process, and but not death itself. So, and then, you know, I kind of do a little riff on let's just play this out. So let's say you're resurrected and after your body dies and you appear in heaven with Jesus or whatever. You know, well, what's there? Is it your body? You know, and some Christian sects say, yeah, it's your physical body. Oh, yeah? What age am I? What? Yeah, how old am I when I'm there in heaven? You know, well, one group actually answered this. 30. You're 30 years old.
Oh,
you know,
really? Oh, gosh.
30 is such a great year, you know.
How arbitrary.
I know. Well, not quite. Because that's when Jesus was crucified.
Oh, okay, but still.
Yeah. Well, but the problem with that is, okay, but, you know, I'm 63 now. So what happened to those 33 years of memories I had if it's my 30-year-old body and brain that are up there? You know, that's a big part of my life. I don't want to miss that in heaven. Okay, well, you get to have all those memories. Yeah, but the memories I have now of being 30 when I'm 63 are very different than those memories were like a decade ago or 2 decades ago. You know, memory, we know, changes and gets edited. And in this sense, there's no self that's a snapshot of you. It would say, that's it. That's all of you. No, that's just a snapshot. And so that problem of identity in philosophy actually grafts nicely onto the problem of the soul. What is the soul? You know, it's the same thing. It's you. Well, you, we're going to resurrect you. We're going to copy you somehow. And so the same problems that, you know, religion has in this sense, I think the mind uploaders and scientific attempts at this also have. But before we get to that, you know, it's just this idea of this afterlife. Like I quote from my friend Julia Sweeney, the Saturday Night Live comedian, and her Letting Go of God monologue when the Mormon boys come around to her apartment, her house in Hollywood, trying to give her the pitch for Mormonism. And, you know, when you die, you're made whole again, and the blind shall see and the deaf shall hear and the crippled shall be healed. And so Julia says, well, you know, I had my uterus taken out because I had uterine cancer. And so when I die, do I get my uterus back? You can imagine 18-year-old boys going, what? And so they go, yeah, you get it back. She says, I don't want it back. And then she says, what if you had a nose job and you liked it? I don't want my old nose back. You know, so it's like, okay, so then some other sects say, no, it's not your body, and forget all that silliness. It's just your soul. But, okay, but what is that? You know, again, it's just a copy of what? You know, all your memories, but you're more than your memories. You're also your point of view, your point of view self, it's called, instead of your memory self. That's you looking out through your eyes at the world. The experience you have, the continuity of life from day to day goes away a little bit during sleep. And more so during general anesthesia. But so when I die will I wake up? I'll open my eyes and be looking at something in heaven. And I mean, when you start thinking about these things seriously, it none of it makes any sense. Which is why I think the scientific attempts are at least interesting, because they have this idea of a continuity. You just keep going, like you're chronically frozen, and 1,000 years from now, somebody wakes you up and you're looking out through your eyes again. That's their idea. I don't think this could ever happen, but that's the attempt. So they at least meet the problem of identity and the continuity of self from one moment to the next.
Well, and it's really interesting how our scientific understanding of ourselves and what makes self has raised these questions with some older ideas of soul and just waking up in heaven, you know, questioning what is the essential self that is waking up there. And that takes us into the second part of your book, which you entitle The Scientific Search for Immortality. So now we're getting into some of these topics that you alluded to before of a more quote unquote scientific attempt to achieve immortality. And so you start by looking at some of the New Agey kind of brands of spirituality taught by gurus like Deepak Chopra and Eckhart Tolle. I think I'm saying that right. So can you tell us why you see a connection between their theories and the scientists' approach to understanding consciousness?
Yeah, I didn't want to leave out non-Western traditions on this topic. You know, those of us that are Westerners are often accused of being weird, you know, Western, educated, industrial, what's the R? I forget now, and then Democratic.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, that there's other parts of the world. Okay, so what do they believe? And you know, the biggest tradition, you know, sort of Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, that kind of Eastern wisdom tradition, as it's called. And the most famous practitioner of that in the Western world is Deepak Chopra. You know, his whole thing is kind of a westernized version of these Eastern traditions. And I thought that would be of most interest to, you know, Western readers of my book. And so I got, you know, I've known Deepak for a long time, and we've kind of been at odds with each other for decades. And, you know, but now we're kind of friends. And so I really inculcated myself into his worldview just to understand it. You know, what is it you're talking about here when you die? And, you know, where do you go after you die? You know, where were you before you were born is my answer to that. Well, Deepak's answer is that's not even the right question. You're not going anywhere. You're just returning to where you used to be in this cosmic consciousness. That consciousness is the primary substance, but not even substance. That's not even the right word. He calls it the ontological primitive. There's nothing to get under consciousness. It's not like boring into atoms and you get subatomic particles and then quarks and then strings. It's nothing like that. That all this material stuff is just a temporary instantiation of consciousness. So we're still a conscious state, just not instantiated in material stuff anymore when you die. That's their idea. So I just wanted to understand that and kind of go through some of that. And there, at least there's some idea of, you know, that your conscious awareness, self-awareness, your sentience, that's who you are in that worldview. And I think there, at least, there's some idea of, you know, making the world a better place now, in that idea of, you know, create our own heavens on earth here. You know, that's what they're trying to do. People like Deepak and Eckhart Tolle, you know, Eckhart's famous for his book, The Power of Now. And what they mean is that there is no past. You only have the memory of your memories of the past. And these things have happened already. You can't do anything about it. So don't worry about it. Quit obsessing about the past. And the future hasn't happened yet. So, well, it's okay to plan for some of it, but overly obsessed about planning for the future, you're going to miss now. So now is the only time that really matters. And, you know, in a way that's true by definition, although I'd like to remind Deepak, you know, my mortgage is due next week. do I have to pay attention to that, or can I ignore that? And, you know, of course, obviously you have to have some planning for the future, but I get what the appeal of that. You know, I went to one of Deepak and Eckhart's big events here in LA. You know, they filled the Shrine Auditorium. This is like 6,600 seat theater. It was filled. You know, these are people that paid like $100 a piece. I mean, this is, you know, what is it? $660,000 for the night.
Wow.
I mean, yeah. And these are, you know, well-dressed, you know, pulling up in Lexuses and Teslas. And, you know, these are, you know, a lot of celebrities from Hollywood were there. And, you know, these were not uneducated, hoi polloi, nobodies, you know. I mean, this is obviously a well-educated, well-read audience here. And, you know, there's something appealing about this. And in that case, it's definitely not the, you know, you're going to heaven to be with Jesus crowd. This is something else. And that explains that. Data that finding I report in the book about that a third of atheists report believing in the continuation of consciousness after death. You know, say what? Atheists? I thought they didn't believe in God or the afterlife. Yeah, that's right. But they're still kind of subject to that idea that somehow maybe your consciousness continues in some other state. And, you know, a lot of, I think, agnostics and atheists, they tick that box, you know, spiritual but not religious. Maybe they're followers of people like Deepak and Buddhism and you know, the eternal return of consciousness in some other form and that sort of thing. So they're not hardcore materialists like me that just, you know, believe that nothing happens. It's the end of everything when you die. So, but I'm in the minority for sure. I believe in that.
I guess I am too, because I share your belief. I use the same kind of example that you do with the question of, well, where do you think you were before you were born? You know, you weren't experiencing your absence. So, but But anyway, next you examine near-death experiences. This is the logical next place to turn, I suppose, because it may be the closest thing we have to something like evidence for consciousness after death, unless that's just the hallucinations of a stressed brain or something. Do you want to tell us about your research into that topic?
Well, I think that is what it is, something like what the brain does when it undergoes extreme stress, like a heart attack, near drowning, problems during surgery. There's a lot of different conditions, oxygen deprivation. These sorts of things seems to trigger these anomalous psychological experiences that people have. So first, I acknowledge that the experiences are real, but what we want to know is, do they represent something out there in the world? You're going someplace versus just only in your head. And of course, we can't get inside people's heads when they have these experiences. We only have their words to report it. So I believe them when they say, boy, I had this wild experience, floated out of my body, went through the tunnel, the white light at the end of the tunnel, all that. I believe them, but I don't believe that that represents a place where they go any more than I think that the person that takes ayahuasca and says, oh my God, you should see where I went. There were these fantastic beings and creatures and colors and sounds, and I felt great love and all this stuff. Yeah, I know. You took an acid trip, essentially. you took drugs. You know, that's what drugs do. But, you know, to the ayahuasca taker, you know, they really feel like they went somewhere. And that's true with people I've talked to, like Eben Alexander. He wrote that book, Proof of Heaven, is probably the most famous of the NDE books. He's famous because he's a Harvard-trained neurologist. So, you know, he knows more about the brain than I do. And he knows all the research I cite in the book about, you know, you can accelerate pilots in a centrifuge, and as they're blacking out, they have these like near-death, out-of-body type experiences. Or you can tap parts of the temporal lobes of an electrode during open brain surgery, and the awake patient will report floating out of their body and being up by the ceiling looking down and so on. We know this is in the brain, 100% in the brain for sure. But the power of experience, the people that have it, is just overwhelming. And so, like, I've met Eben several times on TV shows and in the green room. You know, I'll ask him, you know all this stuff that I know. Why don't you attribute your own to what you surely attribute other people's experiences to, which he used to, but now that he had his own, he doesn't anymore. That they're actually like the ayahuasca taker, they're actually going somewhere, heaven. Now, it's interesting that although there are some similarities, the tunnel and all that, you would expect that because as the oxygen shuts down, on the visual cortex of the brain, you're going to get kind of a tunneling or spiraling type effect. And so there's perfectly good physiological explanations for the components, but people don't report the same place. As if there really were a place you go, you would think we'd get similar reports, but they're actually quite different when you look at them. They're very individualized, which is exactly what you'd expect if it's only happening in your head. And so what we need is some common thing to see. So there are experiments ongoing where experimenters have put like a photograph of something on a high shelf in a OR room or a recovery room where people have these types of experiences in hospitals, facing up such that if they're up there looking down, they'd see this picture. And when they come back, report what it is. Anyway, no one has successfully done this. Mm. And the one and only example I report about the tennis shoe on the window ledge, was never actually corroborated. We only have one story about that. And, so looking for, kind of scientific evidence to support this, it doesn't hold up. It really doesn't. And same thing with reincarnation, the other example. The soul seemed to be hovering around the subcontinent of India looking for bodies to inhabit. I mean, the thing, it's all fraught with logical inconsistencies, not to mention the problems with the reports, the narrative stories people tell about them. So none of that, unfortunately, is evidence for the afterlife, although I'm not sure I really should say unfortunately, because I'm not 100% sure I want there to be an afterlife. It would depend on what it is. As Christopher Hitchens famously said, that the Christian afterlife or heaven is like celestial North Korea, where you have this all-knowing, all-powerful dictator that controls everything you do. That doesn't sound heavenly. That sounds like a dictatorship. We don't want that. And I talk about my college professor when I was a Christian in college. I believed all this stuff, and I'm witnessing to the Lord to my everybody, including my college philosophy professor, and he said, all right, in heaven, are there tennis courts and golf courses? Because, you know, I'd be bored otherwise. I got to have some challenges, you know, make it interesting. And, you know, anything that lasts forever is going to get boring after a while. So, you know, what are we talking about when we're talking about going to heaven? I mean, what does that even entail? So, you know, all of that is just, you know, kind of fraught with logical and scientific problems.
And here in the book is where you talk about the identity problem that you mentioned before, and how it relates to some of the dead serious ways some groups of people are attempting to use technology to prolong life, and how those kind of bring up this question of the identity problem. So I was wondering if you could tell us what you've learned about, and you mentioned them before, the cryonicists, the extropians, the transhumanists, omega point theorists, singularitarians, and mind uploaders.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
I call it the afterlife for atheists. Is again, these are people that want to somehow make it happen. We can't just hope that it happens. And, you know, so the cryonics people, well, first of all, radical life extensionists, you know, what we know from medical researchers that study aging and longevity is that none of these techniques people come up with, you know, diets, radical calorie restriction, various and sundry supplements and minerals and vitamins and all that stuff, none of that is going to do anything for longevity. It may make you temporarily healthier, but probably not, you know, not even that. I mean, just a good, rounded, healthy diet, unless you have some major depletion like an iron or something. Even most of the supplements are just a waste of money. None of that's going to do much of anything. I mean, there's certain obvious things you could do: diet and exercise, don't smoke, don't drink too much, don't get involved in risky, high risk sports like skydiving or something. I mean, things that can take you out. But, you know, none of that's going to make a difference for longevity. It's just maybe you'll last longer before you get to the upper ceiling. What the radical people want to do is, you know, somehow re-engineer the genome, fix the cellular physiology in which cells age. When you hit your 80s and 90s, you know, the drop off is pretty rapid and dramatic in cell at the cellular level. So people like Aubrey de Grey has this program, which he wants to re-engineer cells. Well, he's got seven things he wants to do. He hasn't been able to do any of them yet. And you have people like Ray Kurzweil, the Singularity is Near guy. And, you know, he takes a couple hundred supplements a day, you know, and probably just pisses it out. I mean, I've tried that before. You just have this like bright orange or green urine. You know, it's just your body just flushes it out when it doesn't need it. And that's where most of this stuff goes. And calorie restrictions, you know, there was research on rats and mice. They live longer if you give them, you know, a low calorie diet. Never been corroborated with replicated on primates or humans. But even if it was, you know, so you get to live an extra 10 years being hungry all the time. You know, this is no good. And it does nothing to stop this, you know, the problem of cellular aging in the long run. It's going to get you. And so why can't cells just continue dividing indefinitely? Why do they only divide X number of times? It's usually like 40, 50, 60 times in a lifetime, and then they die. Why can't they just keep dividing indefinitely? Well, there are some cells that divide indefinitely. They're called cancer cells. So somehow we have to fix the problem of cells dividing indefinitely and not becoming cancers. These are not trivial problems. Every one of the problems involved in aging is huge, and we've accomplished next to nothing to stop it. What we've been able to accomplish is, you know, solving specific things. Certain kinds of cancers we've been able to, you know, make some headway on, but some of the other big ones like Alzheimer's, senility, dementia, almost no progress at all. You know, so that this pie in the sky, we're the first generation that's going to live 1,000 years. Aubrey de Grey says, you know, nonsense. No way. This is just not there, you know. So what about the cryonics? Okay, the freezing process or the thawing process is going to destroy your neurons, and therefore your memories are gone. So even if they could wake you up, what's the point? You wouldn't even know you're there. So it's the walking zombie isn't going to do it, if it could even be done at all, which it can't be. And even with the new techniques involving cryopreservation chemicals, you pump the body full of when once the person's dead. By the way, I should remind your listeners, you know, that in cryonics, you are frozen on the worst day of your life, the day you died. Okay, this is not a good start.
That's true.
And according to the state, the government, you know, cryonics can only be done after you're dead. They're not allowed to do it while the patient's still alive. It would be a form of physician-assisted suicide.
I was going to ask, would that change if the laws changed about euthanasia?
Yes, it would help if you did it while you're still alive, and they could somehow pump the cryopreservation chemicals in there through your circulatory system while it was still active. That would help preserve the brain. Because, for example, we can freeze embryos and then thaw them out and bring them back to life. That's called IVF. In vitro fertilization works. But an embryo is really, really tiny, and a brain is gigantic. And, you know, an embryo is, you know, it's a couple of cells, you know, and a brain is, you know, 100 billion cells. So the damage is going to be extensive if the cryopreservation isn't done perfectly. And we're not even close to being able to do that. So that leaves the problem of, again, the problem of identity. If your memories are shattered and gone, then what's the point? You're not being brought back at all. And that brings me to the big one, is this whole idea of mind uploading. There's different versions of this, but the idea is we copy your connectome. The connectome is the analog to your genome. It's the copy of so first of all, yourself are not your physical material self only, because that gets replaced every 7 to 10 years. Virtually all the cells in your body now are not the same material they were a decade ago. So it's not just the stuff that you're made out of, it's the pattern of you. So the idea with the connectome, it's the pattern of your memories that we want to preserve. So if we could somehow copy that. Now, the only way to do this at the moment would be to, you know, after your death, just take your brain out and slice it in an electron microscope, you know, scan it in an electron microscope and copy all the synaptic connections where the memories are stored, and then upload it into a computer or the cloud and turn it on. And so the idea is you would appear there. There's a movie about this. Johnny Depp plays this computer scientist that gets poisoned. It's these terrorist attack kind of thing, and they give him polonium, so he has like 2 weeks to live. So he figures out, he copies his connectome, puts it in the cloud, he dies, and they turn on the computer, and there he is. He's, you know, in there looking out through the little camera hole or whatever. Okay, this isn't going to happen. It's just a copy, if it could even be done, which it can't. But let's play science fiction for a moment and say that, say, 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, there's a sophisticated fMRI brain scanner, and we scan your connectome while you're standing there. You're still alive. And we slide you out of the computer, out of the scanner, and then we turn the copy of you on in the cloud or computer. And you're not going to suddenly go into there. Your point of view is not going to transfer into the cloud or the computer. You're going to still be sitting there looking out at the world through your eyes. So you're going to look at that copy and go, well, that's not me. That's a copy of me. Even if the copy says, I am you, it's not you. And so even if this could be done, I contend. Now, I will admit that there's much disagreement about this. This is kind of a big philosophical debate involved with the problem of identity. Who are you? And I contend you're not just your memories. You're also your point of view. And if the continuity, it doesn't last and continue, and I don't see how it would jump from your head into the computer or even a clone. And so, therefore, that's not you. It's just a copy. And no more does the twin look at its sibling and go, well, there I am. Or there I go. No, it's just a copy of me. And anyway, so I find all this stuff super fascinating, because the people that are involved they love science and technology. But I enjoy it in the same way I enjoy reading science fiction. But that doesn't mean it's true or that we should put our hopes into it. And I find it, I mentioned earlier, I was religious. I was an evangelical born-again Christian for about 7 years in my youth. High school and college. And, you know, so I went to, I've been to a lot of churches, and I know what it feels like to sit there and, you know, think, hey, we're the chosen ones. We get to live forever. We get to go to heaven, all that. That feels good. And I noticed that, like, when I went to the Singularity Summit, and there's Ray Kurzweil giving his I Have a Dream speech about, yeah, we get to live forever and all this, we get to the Singularity in 2040. Yeah, blah, 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 wow. You know, and it's like, oh, come on. You know, who am I listening to? He is like the preacher again.
That's fascinating.
I don't want to call it a cult, but it feels a little bit like a religious impulse.
Yeah.
You know, again, that chosen thing. We're the special generation. We're the ones that get to make it. You know, your skeptical alarm should go off.
In your next section, you explore the sort of strange state of contradiction that despite living in a time of unequaled affluence and technologically created ease, we actually remain fairly pessimistic about the present. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is the utopian part of the book. I wanted to cover this subject because I dealt with it a little bit in my previous book, The Moral Arc, and I wanted to play with it a little bit more in this, in the idea of creating heavens on earth. And if we can't go somewhere, heaven, the afterlife, whatever, maybe we could do it here. And of course, that's been the impulse of utopian writers and doers for centuries, and they always fail. You know, so why is that? And so then I also play with the idea of progress and decline. And there's an interesting cognitive effect that that's called the negativity bias. That is, although we tend to think of our own lives in a slightly more optimistic, with a slightly more optimistic bias, in which we think, you know, our lives are going to get better, but society as a whole is going to hell in a handbasket and things are worse than they've ever been. And if we can only get back to the good old days, whenever that was, the 1950s, the ancient Greeks, whatever, everybody has a different version of the good old days. But this idea of decline is the result of the fact that we notice more bad things happening than good things happening. For a simple cognitive reason that we evolved, the propensity to notice things that could take us out of the gene pool rather than notice things that could make life slightly better tomorrow than today. And the reason for that is the second law of thermodynamics, entropy. There's more ways for things to go wrong or bad or just dissipate than good. And creating a little lump of organized material out of the entropy of the universe actually requires energy. You have to put energy into the system to make it come together, and that's hard to do. So you know, all of life is kind of a pushback against entropy. We mentioned the extropians earlier. That's sort of a half tongue-in-cheek name group that they're against entropy. You know, well, you can't do it. Ultimately, that's what's going to get us. But natural selection is the one driving force that pushes back against entropy. So the second law of thermodynamics is really the first law of life. It's pushing back against entropy. But that fact that there's more ways for things to go wrong than good means our psychology evolved to pay more attention to that. So that's kind of the driving force behind why people think things are getting bad and they were better before. And then the utopian part comes in. Well, let's see if we can do something about it. Let's see if we can engineer the perfect society. So anyway, I go through all that and show why that always fails. Basically, human nature is too diverse and changing for any one system to work. There is, if you ask what's the perfect society, the answer is no such thing. And there never will be because people have changing interests and desires and wants and needs and so on. So, you know, so even the attempts to create a heaven on earth can't work. And so we end up there with more skepticism.
Yeah. In fact, you show how utopic thinking in the past, especially, has been tied to the worst kind of racism and nationalism, unfortunately.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, because we're also tribal and we can imagine a perfect world in our heads. And then when not everybody goes along with it, then our tendency in a utilitarian like calculus, well, you know, if we're talking about a perfect society where everyone's happy forever, if it weren't for this group over here preventing us from getting there and creating that perfect society, whoever they are, the Jews, the Hutus, the Native Americans, whatever, you know, we got to get rid of them. And that's really, it's one of the worst things that's ever happened in the history of our species, is this whole idea, this of a perfect society we can reach if only we can get rid of these people that are preventing us. And that's really the basis of genocide. It's what's led to some of the worst things our species has ever done to one another. So the consequences of that idea are pretty serious.
In the fourth and final section of your book, you begin by considering the question of why we die, and you talk about proximate causes and ultimate causes, as well as some of the latest efforts from biology to understand the aging process. So, tell us, are we going to see a cure for aging anytime soon?
No.
You alluded to that before, yeah.
I think the most we can hope for. Well, let me put it this way. You know, when these people I've gotten to know say, you know, Shermer, don't you want to live to be 500 years, 1,000 years? I say, look, just get me to 80 without cancer, 90 without Alzheimer's, you know, 100 without being senile in a bed on a morphine drip, just oblivious to the world. You know, so just one problem at a time. And, you know, let's just try to increase the quality of life for more people in more places longer, step by step, year by year. And so don't worry about 1,000. We don't live 1,000 years from now. We live now and next year. And then, so in terms of why we die, okay, well, so first of all, we have a tilted, skewed psychology about that. You know, we focus on what's called the availability heuristic or bias, that, you know, we notice the things that are most available in our memory. You know, so if you ask people, what are you most worried about? You know, oh, terrorist attacks and shark attacks and, these kind of killer bees or whatever. You know, no, these are like way, way down the list, you know, like 100th on the list of things that'll take you out, you know, after cancer, heart disease, automobile accidents, live in America, guns. You know, these things have much higher rates of taking people out than these other things. So, but that's only the proximate, cause of death. Ultimate, you know, why do we have to die in the first place? Why can't we just live forever? And again, it's that second law of thermodynamics, entropy. You know, the system is designed to run down. Yeah, but my little infant, you know, he continues to wind up. I mean, he's just, cells are dividing like crazy. He's growing, and you know, why can't we just do that forever? Just stay young and healthy, and our skin is taut and tight, and our heart is, you know, young, and our cells are clean, and you know, all this. Why can't that just continue like it does in childhood? Okay, so the second. Law of nature there is evolution. That the way to say this that it's not too misleading is that, you know, natural selection only allocates enough energy from the environment to get your genes into the next generation, say two generations after you. After that, it doesn't need you anymore. Okay, so the way to think about this is that what's the purpose of life? It's to survive and reproduce and get your genes to the next generation. But it's not enough to just have sex once and then check out and hope that the offspring grow up and become, you know, reproductively successful adults. No, you gotta nurture them, particularly if you're a slow growing species like us. So it's good for you to live well into your 20s, 30s, and 40s to make sure your offspring grow up into their 20s and 30s. So you really need to live maybe 60 or 70 or maybe a little bit more grandparents play a role in helping their kids raise their children. So grandparents and their grandkids. But after that, really, what purpose are you? What we don't really need great grandparents or great great grandparents. There's enough caretakers for the children to grow into reproductively successful adults that you're just really no longer needed anymore. In other words, because of the limitation of energy, there's only so much energy capture in an ecosystem that it's better that the growing young children get the energy to make it to adulthood so they reproduce, than that the grandparents live an extra 50 years and become great, great, great grandparents. And those are the two ultimate reasons why we die.
Right.
That we die so others can live in that sense.
So in the last chapter, you turn to the question of finding meaning in life. And you start by talking about experiencing a sense of awe. And you go on to argue that everything in our environment, including us, is imbued with purpose, no deity required. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so I didn't want to leave the book on a down note, like, well, we all are going to die and there's no perfect society now. Because that's not the way I feel at all. You know, I'm by nature kind of an optimistic, cheery person. And, you know, so I'm not worried about death personally, but what about other people? And you know, what's the purpose of life if this is all there is? And okay, so in part, I call this Alvey's error. Alvey is Alvey Singer, Woody Allen's character in Annie Hall. And at the beginning of the film, near the beginning of the film, he has this flashback as a child where he refuses to do his homework and his mom takes him to the psychiatrist. You know, Alvey, why won't you do your homework? And he said, the universe is expanding. The universe is expanding. Yeah, the universe is everything that there is. And if it's expanding, then one day it's all going to blow apart. So none of this matters. I don't need to do my homework. And his mom yells at him, what's the universe going to do with it? You live in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn's not expanding. So get back to work. And that's right. We don't, you know, it doesn't, whether there's an afterlife or not, doesn't really matter because we don't live in the afterlife. We live in this life. And whether this is a hereafter doesn't matter because we live here now, not in the hereafter. And so ultimately, what we do now is everything. It's the only thing that counts. And so, what should we do then to lead a meaningful life? And so I explore the psychology of that in the last chapter. And I think I'll leave it to your listeners to read it because I gave it some thought and tried to write poetically about that. But I'll give you a hint. It's not just being plugged into a morphine drip and having, you know, the happiest day of your life every day, just goofing off and doing nothing. That's not going to do it.
Right. And I'll also mention too, that you point to the fact that a heightened awareness of mortality tends to bring out the best in people. So, but I'll leave it there as well.
That's right. Yeah, I think it does. So I end on an uplifting note, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Michael, we've taken up a lot of your time. I want to thank you again so much for agreeing to come on the show. But before we go, can you tell us what you're currently working on?
Well, I always have my monthly column in Scientific American I'm working on and so on. I have a few television projects in the works to, you know, do some documentaries based on my work. And I'm trying to decide which book to write next. I haven't made that decision. I actually have a kind of a secret desire to try my hand at science fiction, although I've never done it, so I don't know. But there's enough of these things that, you know, I've written about in terms of nonfiction that it would be fun to spin into a story if I could do that. That would be a challenge. And always with Skeptic Magazine, looking in to see what needs to be addressed. And, you know, at the moment, it's this whole idea of fake news and alternative facts and postmodernism, and there is no truth. And there's kind of a new war on science from both the left and the right. And, you know, so that's kind of my, you know, day job project is to combat that.
Right. Well, those all sound excellent. So thank you so much again. I really, really enjoyed being able to chat with you. And hopefully maybe in the future, we'll be able to talk to you again with some of your future projects.
Well, that'd be great. No, and I appreciate you having me, and thanks a lot.
Thanks again. Goodbye.
I want to thank you for listening to the podcast today. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Shermer about his book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. You can find out more about his other books and publications on his website, michaelshermer.com. Also, be sure to like the New Books in Secularism channel on Facebook and follow the New Books Network on Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. You can also find me on Twitter at Carrie Lynn Land. That's at CarrieLynnLand, where I generally post about science fiction and science and tech news. Did you find this book fascinating? Let me know. I'd love to hear what you think. Goodbye. Until my next conversation about new books in secularism.